This is Voices of Our World. I'm your host, Eileen Bott.
Woke up this morning with my mind stayed on freedom. Hallelujah. Hallelujah.
Hate fights hard to protect itself. In 1983, the headquarters of the Southern Poverty Law Center was burned to the ground. For the perpetrator, it was an act of self-defense. The SPLC has stood toe-to-toe with hate groups in this country since 1971. Founding attorneys Morris Dees and Joseph Levin helped implement the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 65. Recognizing that most young racists had parents who led the way, the SPLC began the Teaching Tolerance Office to inspire an alternative. Mark Potok and the SPLC's Intelligence Project, however, track the inveterate hate groups, including those who subvert religion. Kathy talks with Mark Potok about the infamous preacher from Kansas, Fred Phelps, who stood with his family outside the funeral of Matthew Shepard, a college kid beaten to death in Wyoming for being gay. Phelps and crew held up placards stating that God hates fags. Kathy and Mark Potok.
It isn't until a major episode comes into the public light, like James Byrd's death. You can't even imagine things like this. Or what happened to Matthew Shepard, or equally as hideous, was what the Reverend Phelps did at the funeral for Matthew Shepard.
We are really operating on the theory that to sort of throw light on these people, to turn a light under the rock, is a good thing. It has a healthy effect on all of us as a democratic society. It's better to know what these people are up to than not to know. Fred Phelps, of course, is the man who runs the God Hates Fags website. He picketed Matthew Shepard's funeral with signs like, "Thank God for AIDS," "God Hates Fags," and so on, that sort of thing. I mean, just incredible stuff. In the case of Phelps, we did a story with real news value. Phelps essentially celebrated the attack on the World Trade Center, saying that this was God's punishment on us, we Americans, for being a quote-unquote fag-enabling nation. But in any case, what I want to say is that we did not set out to write yet another story about what an ugly fellow Phelps is. Instead, we went to Topeka, Kansas, where he's from, and did a story about the way that Phelps and his congregation have essentially held the city hostage. The police had been completely cowed by Phelps, who is actually a disbarred attorney, and his many children. He's got 13 in total. Most of them are lawyers. And they had really pushed this entire city into submission. And, you know, that's what we try and do. We try and really tell people what's happening out there and how, in some cases, it affects their lives.
Where is the best place we can work against this kind of thing? Is enough being done in the schools? Are we talking to our kids?
No, enough is not being done. You are certainly right that the schools are, in many ways, where the rubber meets the road. After all, the future is our children and what they think and how they're going to be raised. SPLC, you know, where I work, has a large teaching tolerance program aimed at kids. But I can tell you, it's not enough. Right now, we're monitoring a kind of outbreak of real race hate and violence in several California high schools and even middle schools. They have had to shut down some schools, in one case for many days on end, because of really kind of riotous race conflicts between black and Hispanic students. It's not always blacks and whites at all. And to me, that's an obvious reflection of what's going on in the society at large, which is, I think we're clearly suffering a kind of resurgence of segregation, both residential and educational, and racial feelings. Racial nationalism is what I would describe it as. The reality is that we go through pendulum swings and people react to things that are really occurring in the world out there. So while these people in this movement's ideas are really quite wacky, they don't come from absolutely nowhere. They're not just all a bunch of maniacs who for some reason want to sort of slaughter the Jews or whatever it may be. Many of these people are reacting to huge changes that are occurring in American society in general. You have large groups of people who are in very difficult economic straits as a result of these huge changes in the world economy. You know, so you've got steel workers in France, auto workers in Chicago, who are really no longer able to come close to doing as well as they did 20 years ago. And, you know, for some percentage of people who are feeling those kinds of pressures, the easy answer is to scapegoat someone else. It's not because I failed to get my high school degree all my troubles are because that black family moved in at the end of the block there.
Well said. Lastly, Mark, for people who would like to get involved at any level, whether you're a parent, a teacher, or whatnot, what tips would you give them? Are there places on your website that would help?
Yeah, we have a website called tolerance.org that really relate directly to communities and community activism. So I think that's a useful place to start.
Thank you very much again, Mark Potok.
Well, thanks for having me.
I'm so glad, I'm glad to have many friends, black and white, Indians and colors, national, international. I'm so glad.
Back in 2001, the city of Durban, South Africa, hosted, or tried to, the United Nations Conference Against Racism, Racial Discrimination, Xenophobia, and Related Intolerance. The overly ambitious but well-meaning conference quickly fell apart because several of its stated goals had participant nations, including the United States and Israel, withdrawing in protest. One of those goals was to explore whether countries that had participated in the slave trade centuries prior would be willing to pay reparations to the descendants of slaves. 200 years later, the issue is not closed. But how and who would decide what the dollar value is for generations of lost liberty? During a visit to Mary Knoll, John Baines, director of the Office of Black Ministry of the Brooklyn Diocese, told our producer, Eleanor Ostrinsky, about his recent trip to Ghana, visiting the places where captured Africans were held before being shipped across the Atlantic. Eleanor and John Baines.
Today we have the great pleasure of having John Baines. He's the director of the Office of Black Ministry at the Diocese of Brooklyn, Queens. Welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
In order to understand where we are today, we have to sort of go back into the history that has shaped our lives. And you traveled to Africa.
Yes.
And earlier today, you were talking about the legacy of slavery and how it translates to how we are today. And you talked about an experience in Africa. Would you tell that story?
Approximately three years ago, I had the good fortune of traveling to Ghana in West Africa for the main reason of seeing the slave castles, because the majority of the slaves that were shipped to the Western world came from the west coast of Africa, and the majority of those did leave from Ghana ports. Ghana had something like, I don't know, 14, 15 slave castles on the coast. Right now, only two or three of them remain. One is a government building, and two of them are museums. And when I went there, I went with a tour group of about six or eight of us, and the curator of the museum took us around, and he showed us the conditions that the enslaved people, and as I said, I called them enslaved people and not slaves, because they weren't born slaves. They were captured and made slaves. So these enslaved people were gathered from many sections of the country, some two, three, 4 weekdays walk away from the coast, from the inland. And they were gathered, not selected. They were gathered. The only selection process was that the age, that they weren't too old or too young, and they were healthy. That was the only criteria. They gathered all these people, and gathering the people, they depleted a country. They depleted a country of their most valuable asset, the people. And this went on for 400 years, taking people out of a country and bringing them over to America. After they were captured, and march 2, 3, 4 days a week to the coast where these castles were. And what I want to say is that they're named castles, but they really were warehouses. They were originally built as warehouses because there was a trade that was going on between Africa and Europe. Trade for lumber, trade for ivory and gold and precious stones and things like that. It was a trade going on, so they needed a warehouse. But when they found out it was more money with the developing of America and the development of slavery, they found it was more money in trading people than in trading goods. The warehouses became castles, and that's where they started to store the people. When the people were marched to these castles, sometimes they were held there for 6 to 8 weeks before a ship came in to transport them to America. And in that 6 or 8 weeks, the men were divided from the women, and they were in a room maybe 40 feet by 40 feet. And sometimes there were 200 men in this room. And they never saw the light of day until the ship came in. They're in that dark 40 by 40 room. That's where they ate. That's where they slept. That's where they defecated. That's where they lived for 6 to 8 weeks. The ground was originally cobblestone, but the curator told us, because you could see the indentation of the cobblestone, but the curator told us that the real stone is like 12 inches down, that was the feces that piled up over the 400 years of people being in that holding area. The women were a little different. They were taken over to another room, equally the same size, and they were there. But they did get the opportunity to see the light of day. Anytime one of the soldiers or the generals or whoever was there got a little lonely and wanted a woman, they'll bring the women out from their holding area and parade them around the parade field until the soldiers picked the one that they wanted. Then they were washed up and cleaned up and taken up to the soldiers where they were forced to be with the soldiers. And a lot of children are created this way, but what I must say is that they built a town close to the castle where they raised these children, these half-white children or half-black children, whichever way you want to look at it, as separate people. And it also created a division because these people were quote-unquote different. You know, they were better than the slaves that they were carrying. And in some respects, you got to remember, they were the master's children. So they were actually different. But in these places, in these castles, one of the things that struck me so odd and hurt me so much is that on top of these holding areas, because these holding areas were subterranean, they were in the ground. On top of these holding areas, almost directly on top, was a church. You know, and you say the church on top of a place with all this, I can't even find a word for it. But here on top of the people living and suffering is a church where people are praying. You know, it made you wonder, you know, what were these people thinking of at that particular time?
Thank you very much for being with us.
The pleasure's all mine.
Have you been the victim of prejudice? We'd like to hear your story. Email us. Go to www.marynoel.org/voices. Just click on Contact Us. Or you can call us at 1-877-MARY-NOEL. That's 1-877-MARYKNOLL. Well, that's all for this week, and thanks for listening. Mark Potok and John Baines are just two of the voices of our world. This week's show was produced by Kathy Golden, and I'm your host, Eileen Bott. Our music today was sung by Herb Morrison. To suggest a topic or for more information on today's guests, just go to our program's website, www.marynoel.org/voices. To get Mary Knoll Magazine in English or Spanish, please call 1-877-MARY-KNOEL. That's 1-877-MARYKNOLL. If you missed a portion of this program, you can catch us on our website, www.marynoel.org/voices. And please join us next time for more Voices of Our World.